Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
John McPhee's 1977 book, Coming Into the Country, inspired many young people to visit Alaska, many of whom now call the state home. On a recent Talk of Alaska, we interviewed a student of McPhee's who detailed his own journey following in his teacher's footsteps. I'm Lori Townsend, and today we're revisiting my 2017 conversation with McPhee in this special holiday edition of Talk of Alaska.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, on Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hi, I'm Lori Townsend, and today on Talk of Alaska, we're revisiting my 2017 conversation with professor, journalist, and author John McPhee about his 1977 book, Coming Into the Country. Today's show is not live, so we won't be taking phone calls or emails. We hope you enjoy this walk down memory lane.
In 1975, writer John McPhee came to Alaska for the first of four lengthy reporting trips to the state. He was planning to write articles for the New Yorker magazine, and almost as soon as those stories were published, they turned into the book, Coming Into the Country. John McPhee joins us from a studio at Princeton University where he teaches writing. Hello, Mr. McPhee.
Hello. How are you?
I am well. Thanks so much for being available to join us today. And Alaskans, you can join us too. The number statewide is 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. Or if you're in Anchorage, 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Mr. McPhee, thank you so much. It's really an honor to have you on, and there's a lot of excitement here about having you on Talk of Alaska today. Let's start at the beginning. How is it that, how did you end up on your first reporting trip to Alaska?
I had a friend named John Kaufman who worked up there after in the National Park Service. After the Native Claims Settlement Act was passed, he transferred himself up there, and his main thing up in Alaska was Gates of the Arctic, what became Gates of the Arctic National Park. Anyway, he was an old friend. We'd taught school together, and we kept in touch on various canoe trips in Maine and New Hampshire and so on. And he goes to Alaska, came home and telling stories around our kitchen table in New Jersey. And one story after another, and I could not wait to try to follow him up there, and that's how it started.
And where were you in your career at this time? What else had you written about?
Well, I was 44. I had been writing for The New Yorker for about 10 or 11 years. Before that, I worked for Time magazine for half a dozen years, and before that, I was a student. And that was where I'd been before. I'd written profiles in The New Yorker and a number of pieces.
Was it difficult to convince The New Yorker to send you to Alaska?
It certainly was, because William Shawn, the editor of The New Yorker for many years, the most famous one, I guess, he had a lot of idiosyncrasies, and one of them was that he didn't like cold places. He once asked me when I was suggesting Newfoundland as a subject. He said, "Is it cold there?" and so on. He spoke in a very light voice, but he had a very firm attitude. And so I didn't go to Alaska right away, but there came a moment when he turned my he was looking for other editors to, you know, distribute his powers, and he put another person in charge of me for a while, and I was in Alaska within a few weeks.
So
after
he was a good editor, but he had a clear cold bias.
He was, yes, right. he was the top dog, you know, and I had another editor who worked with me on things.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and our guest today is John McPhee, author of Coming Into the Country, as well as numerous other books and articles. He's on the line from Princeton University in New Jersey. Mr. McPhee, when did you know which stories you wanted to write when you first arrived in Alaska?
Oh, no. I mean, you just sort of learn on the job. You go around and I knew when I went there in 1975 that I was going to make a trip in the Western Brooks Range in Arctic Alaska, down the Salmon River from up near the Brooks Range Divide, and that was all planned. And so when I first went to Alaska and went to Fort Yukon with my wife and went around to Homer and so forth, the next thing was that trip. And then after that, I went around with some people who were doing hearings up in the upper Yukon, and that's how I got connected with Eagle and Central and Circle Hot Springs.
A really exciting time for sure. When you first came to the state, did you think you would make so many trips, end up making so many trips, and stay for so long?
No, I guess I didn't. I mean, I never do. Most of my pieces have started out as ideas for very short things, for the Talk of the Town section of the New Yorker, for example, and then they just grow and grow. But I did know that I was going up to Alaska to do a longer piece, but I didn't know that it would break down the way it did into three different projects and so forth.
If you're just tuning in, this is Talk of Alaska. John McPhee is our guest. He's on the line from Princeton University. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255, in Anchorage, 550-8422, 550-8422, or you can email us talk@alaskapublic.org. If do you still have your original copy of Coming Into the Country? And did you learn something about Alaska or yourself that surprised you? Give us a call and pose your question to Mr. McPhee. We have a question that came in online. When you lived in Eagle, did you begin to take on some of the Alaska mindset?
I don't know. I certainly felt, I loved being in Eagle and had some very good friends there, and I admired so many of the people around there. But mindset, it's hard to say.
Of course. And when you returned to Princeton, how difficult was it to write the New Yorker stories? I mean, you were switching from being in Alaska, in Eagle, and in very remote places back to the city.
Yeah, well, I don't live in a city, but still, I wrote something one time which said when I came home from a long, you know, 3 or 4 months in Alaska, the leaves on the trees looked like baseball mitts, and the only thing that seemed to make any sense at all in the environment when I got home was the university, which I don't know, looks pretty good, and I just had to adjust back and forth once I got sort of soaked into things in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. And at what point did you realize that what you were writing for The New Yorker would become a book?
Probably from the get-go, because I was very surprised with my first book when which was a New Yorker profile, and a publisher came along and wrote me a letter and said, you know, would you make a book of this? You could add to it and we make a book. And I was just dumbstruck. And I did so. It was a basketball player I was writing about, and I followed him through the rest of his college season. And this little book resulted. And that took me by total surprise. As things went along, that same publisher, as my publisher today, and that same publisher kept publishing my things after they'd been in the New Yorker. And so by 10 or 12 years, when I was working in Alaska, I was used to having things sort of double-dipped, published in book form after they were in the New Yorker. So I did expect that.
All authors, of course, hope that their books will be well-received and critically acclaimed. But did you imagine, maybe based on the feedback that you were getting from the New Yorker articles, did you have any sense of how this book would be received and how successful in such a long tenure that it would have in the public's eye?
Nobody did. So, and I certainly didn't. And Roger Strauss, my beloved publisher, didn't either, because he didn't print enough copies. And the book was published on December 1st. He ran out of copies very soon, and it didn't have more until the middle of January. If he hadn't failed in that respect, I might be talking to you from Monaco or somewhere like that.
Well, we are going to take, we've got some calls on the line, and I want to let Alaskans know that if you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. We've got John McPhee, author of Coming Into the Country, as well as numerous other books and articles, on the line from Princeton University. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255, or if you're calling in Anchorage, 550-8422. Barbara is on the line from Healy. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. Hey, I got first.
Do you have a question?
I just have a comment. I want John McPhee to know that he is my literary rock star. My dad used to get the New Yorker from its first publication, turned me on to the good writers there. I have read so many of John McPhee's books. He takes us into worlds and ordinary people that we didn't even know about and turns us on to that. He did that with Alaska. Actually, my dad thought that Coming Into the Country showed what nuts we were all for living up here. That's all I have to say. I had to take the opportunity to tell John McPhee what a rock star literary figure he is to me, and many people, I believe. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Barbara. I think that there'll be lots of fans on the line for sure. We're going to take another call. Mike Potts is in. He's calling. Oh, wait a minute. Where are we going? Sorry. All right. We're going to Mike Potts. Hi, Mike is in Arizona.
Hi.
Mike.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, John. Long time no here.
Long time no here. How are you?
Well, I'm doing okay for an old bald-headed fat man. I'm not
How's
really
that line?
Fat. I can still go up a hill, but I'm getting older.
Well, we haven't been in touch for 2 years or something like that. I mean, when we had that exchange recently, it was two, whatever years ago, right?
I can't recall. We didn't talk, did we? We wrote back and forth or some email.
Exactly.
Or something.
No. Exactly. Yeah. It was written.
So can the two of you let us in on this conversation? Where in the book and how this relationship got started? Tell us a little of the backstory here.
Mike?
Is that your end, John? Go ahead.
Okay. Well, Mike lived in Eagle Indian Village.
Sure.
And was his wife, Adeline, was an Athapascan, a Hungwichin. And he was a trapper. He had worked out in the 40-mile country. He came from Des Moines, and when he was a little boy, he had maps of and things about Alaska up on his wall. The Arctic world just appealed to him from childhood, and he went there and set himself up as a trapper and succeeded. He was one person who went through that country you wouldn't want to miss.
Well, we have a question from Mike's wife, Adeline, who says that Eagle Village and Eagle City is having a reunion this coming 4th of July for all former residents, students, teachers, and missionaries. She wants to know if you can come, John.
I'll try.
Well, she'll be happy to hear that. Mike, did you have any other comments, or did you have a question that you wanted to ask today?
Well, no, I understand you're still in pretty good health, though, huh, John?
Well, I rode my bicycle 15 miles yesterday, so that tells you something.
Good to hear.
I was bombed with tick diseases. Are there ticks in Alaska?
I don't think so. Not yet.
There's not much ticks. No, that's one nice thing about this too cold for Lyme disease. But
exactly. And
we talked to you. I was up. I was overseas in Mongolia for about 7 years, and actually 10 years altogether. And as you know, I didn't have much use for Jesus back in those days that you were writing, but I ran just as hard as fast as I could away from him. But he reached out and grabbed me and said, "You come with me," and I ended up traveling horseback over 500 miles at a time, telling people I'd never heard of Christ, living with them, and horseback with a couple other Mongolians and whatnot. And anyway, so we've had some other adventures around the world, and Alaska was where it started. So,
all right. Well, thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah,
for hearing your voice again, John, and God bless you. And we'll be in touch, maybe.
Same to you, Mike.
Thanks so much for calling in, Mike. We had an email question, Mr. McPhee, from Tom McCrane. He wants to know if you ever considered moving to Alaska permanently. He's in Fairbanks.
I was born in up the street from where I'm sitting right now. My dad was a medical doctor who sports medicine was his thing, and he looked after Princeton athletes. And I grew up here, and I've never left. My many children think that's pretty funny. But the great thing about it is that with the work that I've done, I've been able to move around the world quite a bit. For example, to Alaska. No, I never thought of moving there.
Looking back on your time here, how much would you say, or did it, influence the rest of your life? What's the lingering effect of Alaska on you?
Well, I don't know how to articulate that just a bit, because a writer goes on always to something new. It's always hard to leave behind a place you've been so committed to. I'm very nostalgic about Alaska now, and certainly was in the years that just followed that book. And I'll tell you one thing. It sent my daughters to college, and that's no small thing. But it's a whole lot more than that. I think that just being around those people up there must have had a good effect on me, and I certainly grew a bit as a writer by doing that.
All right, we're going to go back to the phones for a moment. Dave is in Fairbanks. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Did you have a question?
No, I just had a comment for Mr. McPhee. I just wanted to let him know that about 10 years ago or so, I bought the canoe and motor from Brad Snow that he used to travel around in the 40 Mile and Yukon Charlie area. And I know that at the time, Brad was moving out of state, and I understand that he might spend some time back in Fairbanks, but if anybody's in touch with him, let him know that Dave and Esther has his boat, and if he ever wanted to use it again, he's welcome to. And if he doesn't know who Dave and Esther is, he can ask my friend Randy Brown.
Perfect.
And I did have one question. I just wondered I have read the book, but I'm just curious. What were the rivers that you got into, other than the ones that you talked about in the book? Or were those pretty much the ones that you traveled around in that 40 Mile Yukon Charlie area?
Oh yeah, well, I went on the Salmon River and the Brooks Range from down the salmon from roughly the Brooks Range Divide to Kayana, and the rest, other rivers would be in the upper Yukon region, tributaries and the main river, and otherwise I, you know, fished in a river in Kenai and stuff like that, but didn't actually go travel on it.
All right, well, thanks very much. Love your book.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave, for the call. We are going to stick with the phones for a moment here, and now we're going to Rich in Homer. Hi, Rich.
Hey, hello. Hey, John. This is Rich Carrazza.
Rich, hello. What a thrill to talk to you.
Yeah, what a thrill. And we only spent, I think I shot a game of pool with you and talked with you a little bit over the years, but heard you were on, and it's great to hear your voice. And you nailed it. You nailed it in that book. I don't know how you did it about me, but you said I was searching for a life in Alaska, and I thought I'd tell you what some of the things they did, if you want to hear them.
Sure.
Anyway, we left that country, and I married the girl I met on the Yukon there, and we had some mining claims, well, and we tried trapping on Twin Lakes. Both those places got put into national monuments, and we got kicked out of both of those places. But I ended up being a commercial fisherman, and we're still doing that, living in Homer, and having a great life. Both of my kids are growing up, and both of those are commercial fishermen in Alaska. So it worked out. 40 years, it worked out great. Thank you for that book.
Thank you, Rich. Laurie, could I tell the story of Rich in
Please
his journal?
Please do.
I was going down the Yukon River between Eagle and Circle City, and we stopped in an abandoned cabin in terrain that had become the Yukon Charley National Preserve or whatever it is. And in this abandoned cabin, I saw sort of tacked up to the wall a journal, and it wasn't short, and it had been kept by somebody who had lived in that cabin the previous winter or winters, and he kept I read stuff in it, and I thought, wow, that's really interesting. And so I stood there in a big debate with myself. I'm a citizen of the United States. The United States owns this cabin. Therefore, I can take the journal, huh? Well, morality won out, I guess, and I left the journal there. I went down the river to Circle City. Somewhere down there, whether it was Circle or Circle Hot Springs, one of those places, I was in a roadhouse having a beer a night or two after getting down there, and this man was there, and we got in a conversation, and I told him about what I've just told you, and he said, I'm Rich Carrazza. And he got up and, I mean, in effect, left the next day or something. He went 80 miles up the Yukon River. He got that journal. He brought it back and he gave it to me.
That is an amazing story.
Am I grateful for that? You guess it.
Now, see, you took the moral high ground, and that was the best thing to do.
I was going that way anyway the next day to get all my stuff from that cabin I left there. Worked out. But I had no idea that what you were going to write about. It was kind of interesting the way it turned out.
I guess at that point I didn't have too big an idea either. just collecting material.
So what do you think, John, about the follow-up to your book, Land Gone Lonesome? What do you think about what happened up there?
I'm not sure I know what you mean, Rich.
Oh, maybe you've never read it.
Describe it.
What's that?
Describe it. Who's the author?
There's a fellow in Fairbanks. I think he's from Fairbanks. He wrote a book to follow up on you.
Oh, Dan O'Neill. Dan O'Neill. No, he's a pal. Anyway, yeah. No, I'm sorry. I didn't click on the title. But yes, I read his book. Sure.
I was just curious what you thought. It was to see you were there when all the people that you wrote about, and then 20 years later, there's nobody. What did you think of that?
I thought the Park Service and the federal government cleared him out of there, and I was sorry.
Yeah, me too. It was a wonderful experience, and I wish the kids today could get to do that, though, the ones that would like to.
Well, yes, I do. I agree with you.
Rich, thanks so much for calling in. I'm really glad that the two of you had a chance to connect. That's fantastic.
Bye, Rich.
Yeah,
thanks,
John,
a lot.
Well, keep in touch.
Definitely. Keep in touch.
All right. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and our guest today is author John McPhee, the writer of the bestseller Coming Into the Country, as well as numerous other books. We're going to take a short break. When we get back, we've got other callers on the line, including Bill Strever, who is also an author and a fan of Mr. McPhee's. Alaska's Energy Desk has been tracking down Alaskans who appear in Coming Into the Country. You can hear those stories in a series airing on Alaska Public Media and APRN this week, and online at alaskapublic.org, or search Alaska's Energy Desk on Facebook. We'll be back with John McPhee as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
I'm Theo Greenlee, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUCB, where I work in On Alaska, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. John McPhee is our guest on the line from Princeton. We're going to go back to the phones for a moment here and hear from Bill Strever. Bill is an Alaskan author of the book Cold, Heat, and most recently the book And Soon I Heard a Roaring Wind. And Mr. Strever is in Honduras. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Lori.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. You're on with Mr. McPhee.
Yeah,
hi, Bill.
I've been listening through the podcast or the webcast and now through your phone. So, but John, you know, there's lots of aspiring writers and active writers in Alaska. I know you know that. And lots of us have been inspired by your work, you know, not just Coming Into the Country, but Oranges, the Pine Barrens, Looking for a Ship, the Headmaster. The list goes on and on and on. And, you know, I think lots of people pick up anything that you've written about, even though it's a topic they may not have realized they were interested in. But in any case, thanks for calling. Thanks for taking the time to do a call on Alaska. I know a lot of people really appreciate it. But here's my question. Here's my question for you. You've been a writer for a long time, and I wonder if you could comment on how the business of writing has changed over the course of your career. And I know that's a huge topic, but I wonder if you had any quick comments for the listeners out there today.
Well, I'll try. It's certainly changed a lot. For example, I was publishing Coming Into the Country in the New Yorker magazine, and it could never handle that amount of space nowadays as a result of economics and so forth. And the digital age has brought big changes, and how young writers figure out how they're going to make a living at it is a huge question now, and I don't really have very good ideas. I have ideas, and I talk to them all the time because I teach every spring semester, and I'm really concerned about where writers will find their markets and how they will support themselves doing that. It's one thing, anybody can write a blog and post it somewhere, but you don't get paid for that, and so that's the parabola we're talking about, and I don't have any big solution.
Okay, thanks. You may know a book called Scratch that I've just started reading that's about that very topic, about how writers are making a living and can make a living or cannot make a living these days.
I don't, and I'm really glad I'm writing it down. Thank you.
It's called Scratch, and I'll send Lori the rest of the title information for you.
Great, that'd be terrific. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call, Bill. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we have author John McPhee on the line from Princeton, the author of Coming Into the Country, as well as numerous other books and articles. The number to call statewide is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Mr. McPhee, you recently, I understand, read Coming Into the Country, the full book, for the first time in many years. So tell us about that. What was that experience like?
That experience was pleasant. And I want to say I'm really grateful to you for the fact that, this happened. I teach the structure of the Encircled River part of Coming Into the Country every year. And so, you know, I'm used to that. But to sit down and read the book, the what they were hunting for and the Coming Into the Country sections of the book, I haven't read in 40 years. And I was, you know, I could meet all those people again and remember all that. It was a really fun experience earlier this month.
When was the last time you were in Alaska?
It was not recently, but I was up there for the when Eagle, 1997, Eagle was 100 years old. Mm. It was incorporated or whatever in 1901, but it was founded in 1897. Fairbanks wasn't even a tent, and Eagle is celebrating its 100th anniversary, and they asked me to come up, and I went up, and I was so grateful for the invitation and had a wonderful trip there. On another trip, I'm with two college-age daughters. I went and with Eagle friends like Brad Snow and Sage Cass and David Evans traveled just for the sheer hell of it. We went up to the Bonanza Creek in Canada and launched our canoes there and went down to the Klondike River and down the Klondike River into the Yukon River and down the Yukon River, ultimately to Circle City and up the Charlie too during that thing. It was about 500 miles with two of my daughters. And I also went up there on another trip in the 80s or 90s and traveled around, saw all the people again.
How much had things changed? How different was it from when you were here reporting for The New Yorker and working on the process for your book?
Well, of course, that last trip is a good 15 years ago now, but the population was growing, almost doubling. I think there were about 400,000 people in Alaska when I was there and about, you know, 750,000 now. Does that sound right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there was that. And as we heard a few minutes ago, the river people weren't living out in their cabins up tributaries and on the river and so forth because they had been sort of discouraged and that had happened. But otherwise, I didn't notice huge changes in the end of the 20th century is really all. I haven't been there since then.
Here's an email. We're getting some email questions. We've got a lot of people on the line. We'll get to some more callers. Here's an email from Alyssa McHold Ellsworth, who says, I'm a longtime fan of Mr. McPhee from his article Oranges through his geology series that inspired a dear friend to become a hydrologist. She says, I grew up in Princeton and he is friends with my father who still lives there. But her question is, how invested are you in places that you write about? Did you have a place in Alaska that inspired you more than any other?
Inspired. I think the thing was that one day, when I was first up there, after the Salmon River trip in the Brooks Range, where essentially we, on the Salmon River, we ran into nobody, as one would expect, and only after we got down to the Kobuk, only three or four other people did we even see on or around the river until we got to Cayana. And they that didn't hadn't altered, but in Eagle, things were much the same. I don't know. I'm not giving you a very good answer to the question.
That's all right. There's lots of other questions we'll get to. So let's go back to the phones here. I guess we'll take Laura in Anchorage. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
Do you have a question?
No, I just have a comment. And in coming into the country and your article in the New Yorker, my brother was the pilot that flew you around when you were doing the section on moving the Capitol. And he died shortly after your encounter with him in a plane crash. But he, you really portrayed, or you really caught who John was. And I just wanted to thank you for that. You probably
thank you for...
may not remember.
I do. I just read. Well, I just read the book again, as we were saying, and so I encountered him afresh only last week. Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laura. It was nice to have that call as we continue on with our discussion with John McPhee. And on Talk of Alaska today, the author of Coming into the Country and many other books. We're going to go to Juneau now on the phone with Dennis in Juneau. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. Also, I really admired Mr. McPhee's characterization. He really nailed Senator Bill Ray, the late Senator Bill Ray of Juneau. And I'm curious as to if he ever felt like he might write a book about the geology of Alaska, or at least parts of Alaska, because I loved his geology series, The Basin and Range and Making California and all that. It was just fantastic writing about geology.
Well, thank you so much. When I did my sort of North American geology thing, I was following the 40th parallel, which is more or less where I live, and just from coast to coast. But the book includes chapters about global tectonics and so forth. And as part of the research for that book, for example, I went to Cyprus and the Macedonian part of Greece. And so I got into a lot of, including the geology of Alaska, but a specific piece on the geology of Alaska would indeed be, I mean, certainly the world, I would be happy to be the author of such a thing. I just moved on to other stuff when I finished that long one.
Well, I'd love to have you come back to Juneau at a time when it wasn't raining. You wrote about rain in Juneau so much. And really, we do have sunny weather here, you know. If you come in May, April or May or up through mid-June, you should come back sometime on a sunny day.
But well, I had some good times in Juneau. But I hopped down there for, you know, various in all the years that I was there. I was in Juneau for, you know, a few days in each trip. And anyway, it was very pleasant. You say that, you know, Bill Ray, he was characterized in the book in a way that you thought fit him. Well, Bill Ray wrote. In effect, he's an easy interview. He's the sort of person that unselfconsciously rolls it out, and all I had to do was scribble. And so that's the source of that profile.
Yeah, well, you did well. You did write an autobiography, and if you get a chance, you should try to get a hold of a copy, because it's definitely life from Bill Ray's viewpoint. And yes, he let you know what he was thinking all the time. I think it's one reason why people in Juneau kept reelecting him, because he did tell us what he thought, even though we disagreed with him.
Well, thanks so much for the call, Dennis. We've got a lot of other folks to get to. I wanted to also get this question in about one of the central themes in Coming into the Country is the balance between conservation and development. which is and has always been sort of the constant refrain in Alaska. In writing the book, were you trying to persuade readers toward one side or the other?
No. I see my role as a writer as somebody who would lay it all out in front of the reader and leave it to the reader to form conclusions and opinions and things like that. That would be my goal. And that's really, it's because I think it's a richer piece of writing if that's the nature of it. And so I've always tried to do that. And every once in a while, I mean, maybe twice in the whole 40-some years, I come out from behind a curtain and start shouting about something. But I don't think that polemical writing that tries to force a point is as interesting as a piece of writing. And what I'm interested in is pieces of writing.
You wrote a lot about wilderness and coming into the country. Did spending so much time in these different wilderness areas change your personal views on conservation?
I don't think it changed my views on conservation very much, but I'll tell you that, I mean, you know, I grew up in canoes in New England and in a canoe tripping camp and all this, and in the woods of Maine and all that, and this gave me the kind of mindset, I suppose, that made it Alaska attractive. But when I got out there in the Brooks Range and everything else, it was no projection of what it's like on a forest river in Maine, let me tell you. So I learned a lot.
We have another email question, one of many email questions. This is from Susan, who says, she's a writer. She's read many of your books and wants to know, she says, many of the people in your books don't come across as talkative types. How do you take notes when you're listening to them, and how do you put your subjects at ease?
That's a big topic, and I have a book. I've been writing pieces on the writing process, and in the New Yorker, there's eight of them, what I'm doing at the very moment is reading galley proofs for that book, which will be published next September, and it goes into this at considerable length. One of the eight pieces is called Elicitation, and it deals with that question that you just said. And it varies a whole lot with the people. Some people are like Bill Ray, utterly unselfconscious, and they just roll it out and they don't care. Other people are extremely aware that there's a New Yorker person here, a person from a publication, that is. It doesn't matter whether it's a New Yorker. And they try to massage the text, in effect, and lead you around. And then there's other people who really are not, even though every single time you let them know who you are and what you're doing, where it will appear and all that, that goes up front all the time. But nonetheless, there are people you talk to who don't really, they're not really aware of what it's like. And that produces a big responsibility on the part of the writer. And so one keeps all that in mind. In the remarks I've just made, I've just touched on that chapter in the book.
All right. Well, we are going to take one more short break. And when we come back, I'm hoping to ask you to do a short reading for us. And then we'll take some more questions as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. John McPhee is our guest today. He's on the line from Princeton University. Mr. McPhee, we'd love to have you read from your book now. There's a passage almost at the very end when you're talking about your experience with the Galvin family as they're trying to mine gold deep in the wilderness. First, talk a little bit about where you were and what you were doing in this scene to sort of set it up before you read.
Sure. East of Central Circle City, and so on. In the mountains there, in the metamorphic terrain, sort of northeast of Fairbanks and so forth. Stanley Galvin and his father Ed Galvin had the idea that they were going to mine a stream that had been mined in the 19th century by, you know, pick and shovel miners, and that probably they hadn't didn't have the sophisticated equipment that could be taken there. So they lived in Central, and they went into those mountains in the winter on frozen stream with a D9 cat. And they got this big bulldozer up there, and they got the sluice box up there. The sluice box was all fitted together in a certain way, so it was the little trailer that went behind the bulldozer. And they made this incredible trip just to get up there. And it was a little small stream. You could step across it. And they mined it. And I guess that's enough. That's the situation. They were up there in this really remote place. And so shall I read it?
Please do. Thank you so much.
Okay. It says, "This pretty little stream is being disassembled in the name of gold. The result of the summer season of moving 40,000 cubic yards of material through a box, of bearing 200,000 square feet of bedrock, of scraping off the tundra and stuffing it up a hill, of making a muck and gravel hash out of what are now streamside meadows of bluebells and lupine, daisies and Arctic forget-me-nots, yellow poppies and saxifrage, will be a peanut butter jar filled with flaky gold. Probably no one will actually use it. Investors will draw it into their world and lock it in an armored cellar, while up here in these untraveled mountains, a machine-made moonscape will tell the tale. Am I disgusted? Manifestly not. Not from here, from now, from this perspective. I am too warmly, too subjectively caught up in what the Galvins are doing. In the eco-militia, bust me to private. This mine is a cork on the sea. Meanwhile, and possibly more seriously, the relationship between this father and son is as attractive as anything I have seen in Alaska. Both of them self-reliant beyond the usual reach of the term, the characteristic formed by this country. Whatever they are doing, whether it's mining or something else, they do for themselves what no one else is here to do for them. Their kind is more endangered every year. Balance that against the nick they are making in this land. Only an easygoing extremist would preserve every bit of the country, and extremists alone would exploit it all. Everyone else has to think the matter through, choose a point of tolerance, however much the point might tend to one side. For myself, I am close to the preserving side, that is, the side that would preserve the Galvins. To be sure, I would preserve plenty of land as well."
Thank you so much for that beautiful reading. This passage really allows readers to peek behind the curtain at your own thought process as you're reporting the story and getting to know the people you write about. Why was this important for you to include that scene?
Well, I'd been listening to preservation versus exploitation for 3 years, and this is the, you know, the basic dichotomy or the whatever, and it was all expressed by this with the Galvins. Also, when I first started out up there in 1975, I went to Circle City to a hearing the Park Service was having, and I traveled with the Park Service guys. That's who I knew when I first went up there. And Ginny Galvin came up to me at that hearing in Frank Warren's, you know, store in Circle City, and she said, "What are you traveling around with these guys for? Why don't you get to know some of us?" And I said, I just popped out of me, I said, "Take me home with you." And Ed Galvin and his wife drove me away from there, and I left the Park Service guys right there. And in Alaska, you kick around from one thing to another. There is no way to make an appointment for an interview or something, certainly not up there. And so I went off to the Galvins, and the Galvins really symbolized this whole situation to me. And then when I get around to the mining thing in the end, it sort of summarized it. It's the it I come closer to, you know, editorializing there than almost anywhere else in my work.
Well, that's a great, I love that story. It sounds like you were doing what all good writers should do, due diligence and making sure you were hearing all sides and all perspectives, and went right home with the Galvins. That's fantastic. We're going to go to the phones again. Sage is in North Pole. Hi, Sage.
Wow. Hello, hi. Sage.
Yes, I'm sitting outside the North Pole Branch Post Office right now on my way to Fairbanks. Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed.
Oh, okay. I suddenly couldn't hear stuff on the radio anymore. Anyway, you were talking about the trip that you made with your daughters and Brad and then Dave and I. And I just the other day, I related to someone a story about going up the Charlie River with you and your daughters and meeting some other people who were canoeing up there. And, you know, we're chatting, and all of a sudden I hear this person say, "You're John McPhee?" And it turns out she was reading Coming Into the Country when she was going down the river. And I thought, well, what are the chances of meeting somebody, reading the same book out in the middle of nowhere, or meeting the author of the book you're reading out in the middle of nowhere, halfway between Eagle and Central?
That's pretty bizarre, all right. Nice to be talking to you. Let me throw in here one thing. One of the so-called river people up there, maybe it was you, wrote me a note a couple of years after the book was published and I'd sent a copy up there and told me that a grizzly had eaten the book.
And oh, no.
at least to see, would I send another copy? So I did.
Well, I can certainly believe that.
Well,
I live in Salton now, and we had a grizzly try to get into our house there. So you can't get away from those guys.
No, I guess not.
Well, thanks so much for the call, Sage. I'm so glad that you had a chance to get on.
I am
too.
That's a great story about a grizzly eating the book. I can't imagine a better end to a great work than having it eaten by a grizzly in Alaska, a book about Alaska. What a fitting end, huh?
Why not?
let's stick with the phones just for a moment. In our final few minutes here, we'll take a call from Eric in Sterling. Hi, Eric.
Hello, John. I'm a longtime fan. In 1978, I was an 18-year-old, left high school after graduating, of course, got on the road hitchhiking, and one of my writers gave me your book, and three trips back and forth to the Midwest before I stuck. In the following years, I did a little bit of mining, a little bit of trapping, a little bit of commercial fishing, but most of my mainstay has been in the building industry, and I still live here in Sterling, still a big fan, and looking forward to more recent works. What are you working on now?
On the book about the writing process that I was describing. It'll take me a good while to get that all put together.
Well, that won't do me much good. Maybe I'll reread one of the old ones.
Well, thanks for the call, Eric.
Okay, thank you for being there. I'm getting them on.
In that vein, sort of the process of writing, what's it been like teaching students the art of writing? What's the most important thing that you're trying to impart to the students that you have?
Details. It's not some major thing, but I pretend I'm an editor and copy editor as well. And I sit down with the student and talk about the piece of writing that she or he has done privately. That's the core of the course. We have seminars, we have visitors, I talk about this and that, and I'm preoccupied with structure, with the structure of pieces. That's the very first day they hear all about the structure of the part of the book called The Encircled River. And Cary Grant said one time, 1,000 details add up to one impression, and that's sort of the theme of my course.
Well, I have. We only have about a minute left, and my last question along that same line is, you've been writing and teaching for decades, and in that time, there's been such a digital revolution, computers, emails, smartphones, social media. There's a potential for mass distractions. How have you seen that play out with your readers and students?
I think they, the ones I see, remember, they're competing to get in the course. They apply and give writing samples and all, and they're really serious. There's no problem with that. If we have one moment, let me say this. Last summer, a black bear went through my backyard in Princeton, New Jersey. I just wanted to add that to all the bear stuff we were talking about before it's too late.
You didn't have to feed him a copy of your book to get him to go away,
no,
did you?
No, he showed no interest, whatever, but did sit down and groom himself. So Yolanda, my wife, was able to photograph him.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us. We're leaving right now. John McPhee has been on the line from Princeton University. Thank you so much, Mr. McPhee.
Well, let me say a big thank you to you.
All right, that's it for us from Talk of Alaska. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com. January 31st is the last day to enroll in the Health Insurance Marketplace. For assistance in your area, go to getcoveredalaska.org or call 1-844-PLANS-AK. This message sponsored by Alaska Primary Care Association. If you're a rural Alaska resident with an interest in preserving subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing for future generations, consider applying for a seat on a Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. Deadline is Friday, February 3rd, 2017. More at 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by your Federal Subsistence Board and the U.S. Departments of the Interior and Agriculture.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.